Welcome to Podcast 10, Latin America and the Cold War. My name is Dr. Benjamin Bryce. This is History 281, Republican Latin America at the University of Northern British Columbia. Today I want to talk about 5 points to illustrate or tell the history of Latin America during the Cold War. First, I want to talk a little bit about the concept of U.S. imperialism in Latin America, then zoom in or shift focus to Latin America itself and talk about how Latin America, broadly speaking, as a region, experienced the Cold War. And then I have 2 case studies. Point number 3 is on Guatemala leading up to a 1954 coup, and then Nicaragua during the 1980s. And finally, I want to conclude by talking about the agency of the Latin American right in implementing and installing dictatorships across the region and how that coexisted with U.S. imperial aspirations and intervention in Latin America. To my first point on the U.S. empire. U.S. international relations in Latin America and elsewhere in the world contain many elements of imperialism. U.S. international relations are driven by self-interest and the pursuit of economic advantages. And since the 1930s, which is quite relevant for the context of the Cold War, also out of the sake of national defense. And so the act of international aggression is defined or justified out of national defensive interests. The United States uses force and has used force many times to attain its goals of self-interest, economic advantage, and national defense. It violates the sovereignty of other countries, and it subordinates other countries to a U.S.-led world order. So calling the U.S. an empire and U.S. behavior imperialistic challenges fundamental principles of national self-understanding. U.S. foreign relations violate core values of domestic national identity. But the United States has other core values that can be found in domestic national identity, and that actually therefore justify or explain this very different approach to the international stage than the national stage. So there's a belief in interventionist military, there's an interventionist military posture. There's a belief that the United States has a special role to play in world history. There's a promotion of free market capitalism as a necessary or justifiable project. And there's a self-assigned mission very deep in the roots of U.S. national identity from the early 19th century onwards to reform humanity or to be a beacon on a hill, to be the example from it that the rest of the world should follow. And so these other ideas play an important role in shaping how the United States behaves towards Latin America. The very existence of the United States also relies on imperialistic behavior. The westward expansion of the country, while not imagined as an imperial project, was the expansion first and mainly onto indigenous territories, but then also onto the territories of Mexico. And so the very existence of the United States as we see it today is a result of a territorial acquisition or expansionism very much in line with other imperial projects carried out by other countries that more clearly use the term empire to self-describe what was going on. So further international expansion, first in the U.S. West and into places like California or Texas, then takes on a more international tone, including the Philippines, Puerto Rico, and Cuba. And then there's just a broader international expansionism that very much follows a line of a westward spread of the United States from the early 19th century onwards. So the objectives of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America over the course of the 20th century has been to maintain the stability of countries for the sake of U.S. investments. So not necessarily to maintain the stability of those countries, but to maintain the stability of U.S. investments. So when there's a stable transition of power, and in that transition of power, something becomes unstable for U.S. investments, a reform-oriented leader, that becomes unstable for U.S. investments, and that preventing that instability is what is driving U.S. interventionism. So local nationalism, labor reforms, land reforms are not U.S. interests. A second objective of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America is to maintain U.S. supremacy, to block European powers from gaining economic and political influence. And this, in the case of the Cold War, there's a constant reference to Soviet meddling in an area where the United States should be the only international presence. At the same time, U.S. foreign policy in Latin America is not interested in promoting U.S. political values. So there are very few examples of the United States implementing democratic systems as a core value of the United States, but instead what it's doing is seeking to maintain its economic and geopolitical interests. So the U.S. empire and intervention in Latin America it's diverse. It's not simply one example of things the United States does, but it does a series of things, and it's growing from the 1850s to the 1950s. In the 1890s, for example, Latin America is often the first place where U.S. companies are establishing an international presence. It began with things like mining, railroads, and sugar production, but then developed into other sectors such as electricity, oil, and agriculture. So U.S. companies in Latin America required billions of dollars in capital investment, and they wanted to ensure the stability of their investments. To give you two very specific examples that then over the course of the 20th century really matter for U.S. companies is that in 1900, Mexico received one quarter of all U.S. foreign investment. So a country that 10 years later embarks on a revolution and then has a series of policy changes in terms of land reform and redistributing wealth to peasants. In 1900, it was a main site of U.S. international investment. Similarly, in 1900, Cuba was the United States' third biggest trading partner. So these are really important economies for the U.S. economy, and ensuring that economic relationship and those economic benefits can continue has been something shaping U.S. responses to political and social changes in Latin America. Another example is that in 1911, on the eve of the Mexican Revolution, Mexico was the world's third largest oil supplier. The majority of that oil production was owned by American companies and American investors. But throughout the region, the United States was actually deeply enmeshed in oil operations in Venezuela, Bolivia, Peru, and Brazil. So before we get to the Cold War, just a few more examples of pre-Cold War intervention, which really sets the tone for how the United States behaves in Latin America during the Cold War. So between 1903 and 1933, at which time there was a notable policy shift, but in those 30 years, U.S. troops invaded Caribbean countries 34 times. U.S. troops occupied Honduras, Mexico, Guatemala, Costa Rica, Haiti, Cuba, Nicaragua, Panama, and the Dominican Republic. U.S. Marines fought in a counter-revolutionary war in Nicaragua between 1927 and 1933 against Augusto Sandino, who we'll get to a little later on in today's lecture. And this is the first time the U.S. got bogged down in a small international war. So if you're thinking of U.S. foreign policy or U.S. interventionism around the world, Latin America is centrally important. The reason the United States does things later elsewhere in the world is often because it first has experience in Latin America, in this case, in getting involved in a local proxy war or a local war and taking sides between two competing factions. In fact, with this U.S. intervention in Nicaragua between 1927 and 33, the government of the United Kingdom denounced the United States as imperialistic. So the British Empire is denouncing the United States as being imperialistic, and perhaps an example of, while not squaring with national self-description, this is an example of U.S. imperialism. There's a brief interlude in this U.S. interventionism, military aggression towards various sovereign states in the Americas under the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt between 1933 and 1945. He begins something called the Good Neighbor Policy. It's initially intended for the whole world, and it starts with Latin America, a common feature of U.S. internationalism, cutting its teeth in Latin America first. And it's a major rupture with the previous interventionist stance towards Latin American countries. In this policy, Roosevelt pledges to respect the sovereignty of Latin American countries, and it's a shift to soft power that actually, in fact, increased U.S. influence. So rather than this hard power of military intervention, seeking instead soft power and a friendly relationship with various countries as a way to achieve U.S. outcomes or U.S. positive U.S. outcomes. to my second point on the Cold War in Latin America. So the Cold War, broadly speaking, is something more than just conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union. It's a period of world history of military and political tension that set the tone for international relations, that shaped the domestic politics, social policies, reforms, and culture of countries around the world. In the context of this growing schism between the United States and the Soviet Union, which during World War II had been allies, several countries, in fact, don't want to participate in this growing divided world. And in the 1950s, there emerges a new idea called the Non-Aligned Movement. And so several important countries, such as India, Indonesia, Egypt, and Yugoslavia, are leading advocates of the Non-Aligned Movement. It's something that's brought forth at the United Nations in 1953. And at the same time, another idea emerges in 1952. A Frenchman coins this term of the Third World. And initially, the Third World was not describing development of, you know, First World and Third World, rich and poor, but instead this third way, this third path of non-aligned. Neither the West nor the Communist Bloc instead there was this third path or the Third World. And what happened, though, was that the Third World generally speaking, underdeveloped economies. And as a result, Third World took on this connotation of economic underdevelopment or less developed than the industrial north, but its original meaning was focused on this geopolitical split between the Soviet Union and the United States and a third path. Now, despite this growing non-aligned movement, countries in Latin America did not have this luxury. The United States viewed Latin America as its sphere of influence, and any attempt to not toe the U.S. line was met with military intervention, economic pressure, and other forms of intervention to prevent a shift towards a neutral, which from the U.S. perspective could be seen as sort of a pro-Soviet stance. This idea that Latin America was our backyard was very influential in shaping U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America, especially in the context of the Cold War. So in the very early years of the Cold War, as the world is splitting up into two camps and a third camp is trying to sort of break free of this two-camp geopolitical reality, the U.S. enacts a series of projects to foster regional unity under its leadership. So the Organization of American States is founded in 1948. It's sort of a United Nations, but just for the Americas, so just a place where the heads of state of every country will get together and sort of accept common principles and objectives, and at the same time work to pressure member states from deviating from this central goal, which is under U.S. leadership. In 1947, countries across the Americas, again under U.S. leadership, signed the Rio Treaty, so in Rio in Brazil, and it's officially called the Inter-American Treaty of Reciprocal Assistance. It's part of a hemispheric defense strategy, so it's bringing Latin American militaries in line with the U.S. military for the sake of what are being described as threats, international threats, which is, in this context, the Soviet Union. The Rio Treaty and this sort of Inter-American Treaty of Reciprocal Assistance was invoked often in the 1950s and 1960s as a way to guarantee that there would not be growing Soviet admiration or intervention in Latin America. The Rio Treaty was used by the U.S. to justify its blockade of Cuba in the context of the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s. And at the same time, though, it was very self-serving. For example, in 1982, Argentina, a member, a signatory of this Reciprocal Assistance Treaty, goes to war with the United Kingdom, albeit at Argentine aggression, over the Falkland Islands or the Islas Malvinas, and the United States does not intervene. So this Reciprocal Assistance was clearly intended to be in U.S. interest, and when it wasn't U.S. interest, the United States just sort of looked the other way. By definition of this treaty and by definition of previous uses, the United States, in fact, should have gone to war with the United Kingdom over the Falkland Islands in the defense of Argentina, because Argentina was at war with the United Kingdom. Another really important way the United States brought Latin America in line during the Cold War and maintained its political and military authority over the region was through the founding of a thing called the School of the Americas, in Georgia. It was founded in 1946. It was a U.S. military training facility, which still exists today, for Latin American military personnel. So its entire function was training foreign military officers from Latin America in the United States. It was giving these, an important part of Latin American military leadership, the skills to help stop the supposed threat of the spread of communism. Also is then to give them the sort of communist Cold War paranoia that these leftist insurgents are a communist threat to their countries and their national sovereignty. So it trained these officials in counterinsurgency and in guerrilla warfare. And it's very much a dirty part of U.S. Cold War history. The United States trained the militaries of Latin American countries with torture tactics. It taught the military leaders tactics to overthrow democratic governments. And it created a whole sort of subversive elite in Latin American societies that were very much in admiration of the U.S. and its Cold War strategies, which then in practice played an influential role in various dictatorships, U.S.-sponsored, U.S.-supported dictatorships across Latin America during the Cold War. So the United States viewed all governments and all economic policies in Latin America through Cold War goggles. Nationalism and local economic development was always seen as something that could be a threat, could be the beginning of the communist influence in the region, or something that would work against the interest of U.S. corporations. So during the Cold War, the good neighbor policy from the early 1930s is ended. And instead, it leads to a more interventionist stance than ever before. The United States supported dictators. It destabilized countries by promoting promoting social policies and land reform, all for the sake of not only looking out for U.S. interests, but also because of this Cold War context, the fear that all of those reforms were in fact markers of a rising communist threat. In the context of the 1950s and 1960s Latin America, the United States preferred anti-communist dictatorships to democratic openness. U.S. companies were placing a lot of pressure on the U.S. government and through the State Department in the 1940s and 1950s and using the Cold War context as an excuse for this because of labor unrest or calls for better wages, healthcare, social security, calls for land reform. Because these economic and social reforms threatened U.S. economic interests. So U.S. companies both called on Washington for support in Latin America, or they increased their patronage of local conservative movements and projects that would help U.S. economic interests and the interests of these businesses to prevent or lessen these social reforms, such as increasing wages, improving healthcare, pension plans, and land reform. To my first of two case studies, and that's Guatemala in 1954. It's the first violation of the principle of non-intervention and the good neighbor policy. Guatemala had a president named Juan José Arévalo between 1944 and 1951, who started a public pension plan, a new labor code, had a new constitution, called on companies to pay workers better wages, and he spoke of a spiritual socialism. As the tension over the Cold War hardened in the early 1950s, a new president comes to power in 1951 who carries on this project of spiritual socialism, improving the quality of life for the majority of Guatemalans. So Jacobo Arbenz began redistributing land. He expropriated, in particular, uncultivated land owned by the United Fruit Company. So a key feature of banana production, which is owned by U.S. companies, is because of fungal infections to bananas caused by cultivation. Companies would then abandon land and move on to new jungle land, clear cut a forest, and then start planting bananas there until the disease then spread and affected their banana crops again. So the United Fruit Company owned a huge amount of unused land around the Caribbean basin, including Guatemala. Seeing this as unused land that could be used for land reform, the Arbenz government compensated the company for its lost land, but very much drew the ire of the U.S. government and U.S. economic interests. There's a particular, you could say, conflict of interest here that the Secretary of State, very much playing a role then in U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, John Foster Dulles, and his brother, the chief of the CIA, Alan Dulles, had a personal interest in the, they were board members of the United Fruit Company. So people who were directly affected through their personal lives or their business lives had the power to influence U.S. foreign policy towards Guatemala. So some people in the United States and in Guatemala began to label Arbenz a communist. And then sort of the thing that sealed the deal in the Arbenz government bought arms from Czechoslovakia. So Czechoslovakia, it's a Soviet ally during the Cold War. It's also a major arms producer. And so this country, which is officially closely aligned to the United States, is buying weapons from the United States perspective, the communist bloc, and which therefore becomes a big problem for the United States. So the CIA begins to work to destabilize Guatemala's government. It's the first full-scale covert operation in Latin America. It required a year of planning, so Arbenz comes to power in 1951, and the coup doesn't happen until 1954. The CIA recruits local enemies of Arbenz. It works to destabilize Guatemala's economy so that Arbenz reforms are ineffective and he'll lose political support. The United States trains a mercenary force in Honduras. The CIA distributed sabotage manuals. The CIA had local assets bomb roads, bridges, and military installations, all as a way to sort of lay the groundwork for what ultimately becomes a coup. In 1954, the Guatemalan military favored the United States over democratic government. An important side note here, Che Guevara, an important leader of the Cuban Revolution and the 1960s anti-U.S. imperialism, is in fact in Guatemala observing, traveling, observing these land reforms, these socialist reforms in Guatemala, and sees this harsh U.S. intervention and stamping out progressive social reforms for workers for the sake of U.S. business interests. And it really shapes his thinking. It also causes him very immediately to flee to Mexico because of this military conflict. And it's in Mexico that he meets Fidel Castro, who himself had been in exile in Mexico. So it's actually plays an important role in shaping future Cold War politics and anti-American Latin American activism. And the experience of Guatemala in 1954. Further shapes how the United States behaves towards leftist reformist governments in Latin America in the 1950s and 1960s. So the strategies used by the United States in sponsoring the Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba as a way to overthrow Fidel Castro and the new Cuban Revolution, the United States borrowed, the CIA borrowed strategies from its early 1950s playbook in Guatemala. To my second case study, jumping ahead to 1979 in Nicaragua, neighboring country of Guatemala. So in 1979, a political group, a revolutionary group that had been agitating in the 1970s, takes power from, called the Sandinistas, they take power from the Somozas, which had been a family dynasty in Guatemala from 1937 until 1979. So a generational dictatorship from 1937 to 79. The Sandinistas, the group that comes to power in 1979, names themselves after Sandino, who was the leader of a revolution in the 1920s and 1930s in Nicaragua, which then led to the rise of the Somozas. It's that revolution that where the United States was militarily intervening between 1927 and 1933, and Sandino is ultimately killed in 1934, which leads to then the Somoza family's dynasty. The president of Nicaragua in the 1970s, Anastasio Somoza, is educated at the U.S. Military Academy West Point. He's very much pro-U.S. and very much a U.S. ally, anti-democratic, and with the full support of the United States. Now, once in power in 1979, the Sandinistas begin a series of Cuban-style reforms, such as fostering full literacy, stamping out illiteracy, greatly improving public health. These are key features of early 1960s Cuban Revolution. And 1979, very much in the same context, there's another government that comes to power in another part of nearby part of Latin America that enacts similar reforms. This greatly worries the United States and particularly its economic interests in fruit production on Nicaraguan lands. The Sandinistas' rise to power in 1979-1980 coincides with Ronald Reagan's rise to power in election in 1980. So we have a shift to the left in Nicaragua, just as there's a shift to the right in the United States, and a shift in the nature of U.S. Cold War strategies, in that there's a hardening of U.S. Cold War strategies in the 1980s. So the United States starts supporting the Nicaraguan National Guard, which had been exiled in Honduras. This National Guard was loyal to Somoza. They go into exile in Honduras. The United States then starts supporting this military group, which opposes the democratically elected government of Nicaragua. This group is called the Contras. It became very well known in the late 1980s United States because of funding. The way the United States funded this group, there was congressional hearings over the matter. So they're called Contras because they were counter-revolutionary. So contra-revolutionarios, if the Sandinistas were the revolutionaries, the Contras were the counter-revolutionaries, and contra means counter in Spanish. So the Contras repeatedly raided Nicaragua. Ronald Reagan called these military raids of Nicaragua and of this reform-oriented, democratically elected government, he called them freedom fighters. The Reagan administration funnels money to these Contras through a convoluted system of arms sales involving also Iran as a way to mask where this money was coming from. The United States mined harbors in Nicaragua and cut off trade as a way to cut off Nicaragua's trade with other countries. So the United States is undermining this government and this country because of its social and economic reforms. It's viewing things through Cold War goggles. Any efforts to improve the quality of life for workers and marginalized rural peoples is perceived as a threat of communism. To my fifth point, the agency of the Latin American right. This is right-wing dictatorships, killing people, torturing citizens is not only the responsibility of the United States government, not only the responsibility of things like the School of Americas that trained Latin American militaries, but also the responsibility of Latin American militaries and the Latin American right or elites that saw benefits in dictatorship over democracy, saw the danger or feared democracy because of the benefits that democracy brought to the majority and therefore, as a result, the things that would, to the detriment of this elite, this privileged elite. So terror campaigns are not only the response of the United States. Latin American generals were adamant supporters of anti-communism. Latin American generals also viewed the world through Cold War goggles and also therefore saw leftist reformers as a problem for their countries. So the United States was appealing to Latin American generals and Latin American business elites who saw the benefit to what the United States was offering. The United States also offered, by supporting coups, was increasing the power of the military, something in the interest of a certain ideology of a military that was interested in attaining political power and not just being a loyal servant of the head of state, a democratically elected head of state. So coups in Guatemala in 1954, in Brazil in 1964, in Chile in 1973, and in Argentina in 1976 were also the result of local military authoritarianism. Landed elites and local or national militaries took advantage of the shift in U.S. foreign policy and launched their own continental counter-revolution. So this is not only a story of U.S. interventionism, but also of the agency of the Latin American right in carrying out these anti-communist campaigns. To conclude, the United States behaved imperialistically towards Latin America over the course of the 19th century, up until 1933, and then again in the context of the Cold War. Yet that interventionism increased in the Cold War. It moved from blockading ports before 1933 with a few brief military interventions, very brief occupations, to instead a system of installing regimes, destabilizing democratically elected governments, and ultimately overthrowing democracies for the sake of protecting the Western Hemisphere, and in particular, protecting the United States from communist threats. The Cold War context stifled efforts for social improvement. So reform campaigns in the context of the 1950s and 60s and 70s in Latin America were viewed by both the United States and local elites as a communist threat, which then made it harder for progressive politics to be carried out. Latin America was important in shaping U.S. foreign policy and U.S. international relations. And it was an important part of how the Cold War played out. Even though it was not a site of great tension between the United States and the Soviet Union, it was a site of overwhelming U.S. dominance, but also therefore an important part of the Cold War. And finally, Latin American militaries and Latin American elites were active participants in the Cold War and in Cold War repression.